The whole idea of this podcast series is that great adventurers share their great adventures, so this episode will be something of a departure. It's aimed at those of you who enjoy wild swimming, as outdoor swimming has come to be called, or think you might get into it one day. Dr. James Douglas is a general practitioner here in the Scottish Highlands, but I knew him better as the guy in the red swim hat who covered two lengths of the pool in the time I managed one. I made a couple of videos recently with Dr. Douglas, who wanted to pass on some safety information to people who are new to wild swimming, and also to alert more experienced swimmers to a couple of medical conditions which are rare but could affect them. In fact, so rare many junior A&E doctors might not know they exist. Before all that, I wanted to know more about how he got into swimming and became so quick.
I learnt to swim when I was a child, and that was mainly in the pool. When I went to university, I took up scuba diving. So that was about 50 years ago. And when you go scuba diving in that many years ago, you end up making up your own wetsuit. And the air supply that you've got to breathe when you're under the water is more limited. So I suppose in those early days back in the early 70s was when I was kind of like learning about hypothermia, the whole physiology of wild swimming, etc.
But you made your own wetsuit.
Yes. That's what you had to do 50 years ago.
Where did you start? I mean, were the patterns or something given away in Scuba Diver magazine? Oh, they were.
Yes, it was that sort of level. So basically butt seams and then taping them and so on. So that's obviously they weren't very efficient. So that's really how I learned about cold exposure in round about here, round about Oban, round about the Sound of Mull. That's where I learned about sort of cold immersion. And sometimes if you only had a limited amount of air on your dive, if you couldn't actually swim, depending on where we were, often we used to go snorkeling as well. So the start of my sort of wild swimming was basically just, snorkeling type stuff as well.
Because diving is quite a different thing to swimming, because with diving,
yes,
you're kicking mainly.
Exactly.
As I remember it from my,
yes,
my training.
Yeah.
So how about the swimming? Because you're not a slow swimmer.
Right. Okay, yeah, so I'm mainly a crawl swimmer, so I think my fastest stroke in the pool is crawl. So I've had a sort of lifetime keep myself well sort of habit of always swimming. So for the past 30 years or so, I've swum most mornings in the pool. My routine is that I swim, I did it this morning, 32 lengths, 800 metres, do that before work, get up and go to work, and that's kept me mentally and physically fit and healthy. So I recommend swimming as a doctor. I would say swimming is a really good exercise. I try and encourage all my patients to swim. When COVID came along and I couldn't swim in the pool because the pool was shut, I kind of converted locally to wild swimming. So I got myself a decent wetsuit and started swimming. I can walk down to Loch Linney, which is just within walking distance of the house. So so certainly over the summertime, I've been wild swimming in the loch.
But did you ever actually learn? Did you ever take lessons in your technique, or did your technique just evolve naturally?
My swimming technique,
yeah.
for swimming or for...
For crawl.
Or for front crawl. No, that's all self-taught. I've never had a lesson in my life.
And your tumble turns and everything?
Yes, just done it myself. Yeah, never had a lesson in my life, no.
What does swimming give you then? What is it? Why is it so important for you to do every day? It's got to be more than just fitness.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the things that swimming does is it's exercise in the water. So you're using all your joints, you're using you're working your lungs hard, you're working your heart hard. And doing by tumble turns, really what you're doing, which is what I do in the pool, then you're bending your neck forward, you're bending your back. So I find if for any reason I'm not swimming, I start getting sort of sore backs and aches and pains and stuff like that. So I would recommend, as a general health benefit, swimming is really, really good exercise.
But does it also give you a bit of peace?
Oh, yeah. So what I tend to do is I do a lot of thinking in the pool. So I often have my sort of creative moments about thinking about what I'm researching and writing about and so on. I sometimes have in the pool, yeah.
Can't really rush the side and write them down.
No, but I do a lot of thinking in the pool, yeah.
It's good to have something like that that kind of loses you. People say that also
absolutely.
On the bike as well.
Yeah,
what do you think about? Think about anything and everything.
Absolutely, yeah.
Because some people find swimming boring.
Yeah. And I completely accept that. I mean, I know plenty of people who just don't like swimming and they've never been in it. But I've found that it's been the sport for me. It's been my lifelong sport, and I've just felt, and I still swim and still enjoy it.
So how do you view the growth and popularity of wild swimming, especially during this pandemic?
Absolutely brilliant. Absolutely fantastic. I'm so pleased that so many people have taken up wild swimming. I think it's a slightly different discipline to swimming in the pool. To me, it's all about taking in the environment, just looking around you. So just locally in the loch here, we have swans, we have oyster catchers, we have all the wildlife that we can see and experience. I think it's just a different discipline. And you're not competing against anybody. Well, some people obviously in triathlons and so on compete against each other. But I think true wild swimming is all about the moment. It's all about where you are, the place. So I go swimming in the local rivers. So Glen Etive is a favourite place of place for wild swimming for me. So last Sunday I was up with my family and my grandchildren and so on up on the beach in Arisaig, and I went swimming without a wetsuit on the beach in Arisaig with grandchildren and so on. So,
but you say it's different to the pool. Is that because in the pool you say you've got your lengths, you do that number of lengths,
exactly.
That's what you know works for you.
Yeah, yeah.
But in when it comes to swimming outdoors, you do something different because
yes.
It's a totally different mental thing as well.
Exactly.
That physical thing.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Do you call it wild swimming or outdoor swimming? Because I know a lot of people are rather scathing about it. It's just swimming. Why?
Yes.
Well, let's distinguish it from, because if you say swimming, I'm going swimming. You don't know if you're going in the pool or you're going in swimming across the sand and mall.
Yeah, quite. I don't know. It's difficult to say. I mean, I mean, people are calling it wild swimming, so fine. So my reaction to the term wild swimming is, well, I think that's what I've been doing for the past 50 years. But if you want to call it wild swimming, that's fine by me.
You call it whatever you call it.
Yeah.
Tell me about the physiological thing that happens when you go into cold water from literally sticking your toe in, or even before, and as a doctor, what happens, and how do you mitigate any adverse consequences?
Okay, I think the main thing to do is taking it slowly. I think the main thing is you've got to get into the water slowly, and you've got to let your body adjust slowly. I mean, some people do go sort of rushing off and diving in. Well, that's fine for them, particularly if you're young and fit, maybe that's okay. But certainly when you get older, I think it's very important to go in and adjust slowly. How slow? Well, I think it's a matter of minutes. I use river crocs, so you're always standing stably on stones or whatever else it is you're standing, and you go up to waist level. I think when you're doing the acclimatization bit, I think it's important not to go out of your swimming depth while you are still acclimatizing. So my first safety tip would be wear shoes or crocs or that sort of thing, that or wetsuit boots that you've got a firm footing on. Go in slowly, go into around about waist depth. Then you can maybe splash your face if you want, maybe even sit down. But I think the main thing to do is let your body recognize slowly that you're making this transition from the land into the sea. When you first go into cold water, there tends to be, you know, large intakes of breath, a bit of, oh my goodness, it's cold, all that sort of stuff. You've got to get over that. You've just got to let yourself calm down, let your breathing settle down. And the other thing is when you're swimming, so although I'm a confident pool swimmer in front crawl, I tend, when I'm wild swimming, I tend to start off using either the breaststroke or swimming on my back. The reason for that is twofold. When you're swimming breaststroke, you've got your head out, so your heat loss is going to be much less when you've got head out. And also you're just kind of, you're looking, you can see better. So when you're swimming with front crawl, you've got your head right the way down and you're just going to see what's in the water. The other thing is when you're moving onto your back, again, I think you can have a little bit more head out immersion, head out, so you're going to get lower heat loss. And again, you're able to see the environment and what's around about you. And I think that's all part of the acclimatization. So when I'm actually swimming, I'm switching all the time, just in and out of breaststroke, backstroke, front crawl, just depending on what I want to do, what the tide's doing, all these sorts of things. So I think being a versatile swimmer is what I would recommend. What's actually happening is that your body has then got to start adjusting to the fact that you've got this heat being taken away from you. So one of the things to understand when you're wild swimming is that we can't shut down the circulation to our head and neck. So the circulation to your brain has to be kept open all the time. So we can't shut down the heat loss from your head. And so what happens is that we, in the physiological adjustment, we're trying to preserve heat at the core of the body. So what happens is that when you start immersing yourself in the water, and the water conducts heat away from you, mainly about 30% of the heat loss will occur via your head and your neck. And the what happens is that your body then starts making these adjustments to the fact that you're in the cold water. So it starts shutting down the circulation to your arms and to your hands and to your legs to try and preserve heat at the core of the body. And that's the key thing that's happening and will happen to you, because you're not going to be able to generate enough heat from your exercise, from your swimming. You're going to lose heat faster than you're making it. Now, there are some very amazing people that can swim the channel, that you can only really do that by a process of your body acclimatizing and training, etc. Most normal human beings can't produce enough energy to swim the channel and keep up with the heat loss. You've got to be a real special person to do that. So if you're just like an ordinary person, you've really got to realize that you're setting the clock as you go in for that swim. You're always going to be a negative heat balance, and by the time you come back out, then you're going to be in the early stages probably of hypothermia. So when you get to the stage of, if you get to the stage when you have immersed yourself in the water and you begin to lose the sense of feeling in your arms and your legs, you can't feel your arms and legs, that's a danger sign. You must start going for the shore at that stage and getting out, because your heat, your core temperature will continue to drop. And the key thing is that your judgment will start dropping. So in the early stages of hypothermia, when your core temperature has dropped from, say, our normal temperature is about 36.5, when you're down to 34, that's generally when that starts happening, when your core temperature has gone down to 34 degrees centigrade, then you're going to start making poor judgments. You stop thinking very clearly. You might swim off in the wrong direction, all these sorts of things. And by the time your core temperature gets down to 32 degrees, the big problem is you're then risking your heart going into an abnormal rhythm called ventricular fibrillation, which is quite near having a cardiac arrest. So you've got to be very careful about your time exposure. So one of the ways that I do that at a personal level is I always wear one of these fancy watches that buzzes at me. So I set it to buzz at me, a swim of eight watch. I set it to buzz at me at 10 minutes. So every 10 minutes, I'm getting a buzz on my wrist, so I know how long I've been in 10 minutes. And if I've been swimming for 10 minutes, if depending upon the water temperature that I've measured, I'll then have decided I'm only going to be in 10 minutes, 20 minutes, 30 minutes, and I will just plan the whole thing around the buzzes I'm getting off my watch. When you come out of the water...
Actually, while we're still in the water, let me just ask you this. Yeah. I had been told, and correct me if I'm wrong, that the good thing to look out for is the way your finger... If you're swimming without gloves, mm-hmm. your little finger and the finger next to it very often will start to claw up.
Yes.
And that's partly in response to the cold.
Yeah.
And that's kind of all right. It makes the catch a bit difficult, but it's not a crucially bad sign. But if your index finger and your middle finger start to claw, that is a huge warning sign. And get out.
Exactly.
So just explain to me the medical reasoning behind that, please, if I may.
Well, what's happening is that your body is trying to preserve heat at the core of the body, and the core of the body is basically your heart, your lungs, and your brain. That's what keeps you alive. So basically, your body is trying to say, we're losing heat from our arms, losing heat from our legs. So what it's doing is it's shutting down the circulation to your hands and to your feet, saying, let's stop pumping the blood around to those areas of the body, and let's try and preserve it at the core of the body. So, I mean, that's a really good sign that you've said, Simon, that if you can't feel your hands, you can't feel your feet, if they've gone into that claw shape, like you're saying, then that means that you've overcooked it and your core temperature is going to start going downhill.
But these are different nerves, is that?
Yes, that's right. So the ones that control these two fingers here are the ulnar nerve, and the ones that control these things here are the median nerve. So the ulnar nerve kind of goes down your arm on this channel here, and the median nerve kind of goes down through your wrist and works these things here.
And if that one goes, get out.
Yes, absolutely.
Good. Right. Let's move on to some of the other warning things you've been telling us about. You were actually taking it on to getting out of the water. So let's talk about getting out of the water now.
Yeah.
Because people get colder after, and they hear about this thing called afterdrop.
That's right.
What is it? And why is it important to know about that?
Right. Well, I think coming back to the business about the safety gear, I think getting out is really obviously really important. That's why I think foot gear is really important. So if you start getting this way, get out onto the shore. So even if you've got to walk back to where your clothes are and all the rest of it, or the car is, or whatever, get out at that point, because otherwise you're going to start getting sort of mixed up. So I think when you get out of the water, your temperature at that point might be around about sort of 35 degrees centigrade, maybe 34 degrees centigrade. If you're getting to that stage of not feeling your arms and legs. When you come out and you start warming up and you start putting things on, so the first thing you do when you get out is you put on a hat. That's the most important thing, because you're losing 30% of your head, of your heat loss via your head and your neck. You can't shut that down, so that's where all the heat loss is from your head and neck. So when you get out, first thing, put on a hat, really important. Try and get out of the wind, because the wind is going to be encourage the heat loss from your body. And then try and get out of your wet things and start putting your dry things on. When you start doing that, and you start doing, say you take some warm tea or coffee or soup or something like that, getting heat into the core, that's really, really, really good. You'll probably go through the stage of starting to shiver a bit uncontrollably. That's your body trying to make your muscles work to generate more heat, because it knows that you're losing heat. The next thing that might happen is you start getting warmer, and once the blood starts circulating again to your arms and to your legs, and the circulation starts opening up again to those parts of the body, you then, with the redistribution of the blood and the redistribution of the heat within the body, you get this phenomenon called the afterdrop. So the afterdrop is about everything equalizing out again. And then your core temperature may then paradoxically start continuing to drop down. So in fact, you start feeling cold and shivery and pretty horrible, because your body is then distributing everything around. And then the cold blood is going back, the cold blood is going back to your heart and your lungs. So actually your core temperature can start going down before it starts climbing back up and getting better.
Do you rewarm with the car on? I mean, I've been told it's getting the car engine running.
Yeah, that's fine. Yeah, yeah. If you don't mind getting the car full of seawater.
Well, that's true.
I think kind of getting out of...
Seat covers and sitting in it and putting your feet in the trunk.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Okay, so, but there are other things that you were saying that we need to be aware of that fewer people might actually know about.
So temperature is the main thing. Once you're ashore and once you start warming up, then I'm sure it'll be fine. But there are a couple of things just to warn you about for more, shall we say, mature swimmers. So people in their sort of 50s and 60s. There's a condition called transient global amnesia, which is just a fancy way. Transient, it does get better. Global, it means it's affecting your brain, and amnesia, your memory is gone. What happens is that so a swimmer who's maybe 50, 60, that sort of age group, come out of the water, they've got themselves pretty cold, maybe they've dived in and they've had a lot of initial heat loss from their face and their head. The circulation to their brain shuts down a little bit, goes into a bit of a spasm, and then when they come out of the water, they can't remember some pretty basic things. So they might not recognise people, they might not recognise their friends, they might go into a pattern of just asking questions and going back over the same question several times. And then what happens is that people might think, oh my goodness, they're having a stroke or a heart attack or something like that. They're then taken to A&E. And in A&E, unless you know about this condition, transient global amnesia, then the doctors might think, if they don't know about this fairly rare condition that affects wild swimmers, they might think that you're having what's called a transient ischemic attack. Now, a transient ischemic attack is important medically because it's a bit like a mini stroke. So in a transient ischemic attack, you maybe lose the function of your arm or your leg, and then it comes back. And then if that happens to you, then the doctors will be looking at your blood pressure, putting you on pills, all sorts of things. It can affect whether you're driving and all these sorts of things. With a transient global amnesia, the wild swimmers thing, what happens is your memory does come back. It may take 5 or 6 hours. It might be that evening. And then you're completely back to normal and you're completely okay. And there's no problem. There's no permanent deficit. But it can obviously be very frightening for the person and frightening for the other people that are around about them. So the key thing is this business that you've lost your kind of like normal short-term memory, so you can't remember people's names. You start asking things, questions over and over again. That's the main thing. You don't lose any, if you lose the power of your arms or your legs, then that is the transient ischemic attack, and that's the serious thing. But if it's the transient global amnesia, then it's a temporary thing. Paradoxically, you can still feel that you might be able to, the normal executive functions, you would be able to walk, you would maybe be able to cross a road, you would maybe be able to drive your car, it's just you can't remember anything.
So if someone you're swimming with presents with this transient
global amnesia.
Would you suggest taking them to A&E and pointing this out?
Yes, I think that's a key thing. So I think that's a message I'd like to get across today, is that it's a fairly unusual diagnosis, that unless you're kind of like up to date on this sort of thing, so a junior doctor or whatever in A&E might not know about this. So I think it's a really good idea, if you are in a swimming party and a swimming party, somebody's accompanying you to A&E to get you checked out, then mention this as a possibility.
There is another condition you wanted to quite unusual, that you wanted to highlight.
Yeah, I don't want to spook people up with all these unusual conditions, but there is a condition called acute pulmonary edema. As we were discussing earlier on, Simon, it's a little bit like mountain sickness. So in other words, you get acutely breathless, as in altitude sickness, but it's nothing to do with altitude. You're in the sea. It's when you're in the sea and when you've been immersed, and it's all about facial immersion and big changes to your blood pressure. So what happens is your blood pressure starts going up through the roof and you feel very breathless. When you are taken to A&E, when the doctors listen to your chest, they'll find fluid in your chest. When they listen to your lungs and so on.
And that's not fluid you've ingested, is it?
No. This is fluid that your body has kind of redistributed around about your heart and your lungs into the wrong place. So it's a bit like it's like a sort of temporary heart failure thing almost. And it's perfectly treatable. What happens is that you just get given things, drugs into your arms that will make you pass urine a lot and kind of dry your lungs out. And then it's all over and it's fine. No problem, no long-standing problem. It can indicate that some people might end up going on to develop blood pressure at some later point. And obviously it's very frightening. You cannot breathe, you feel awful, and you just can't breathe, basically, because your lungs are full of fluid. So again, that's another condition. Which, when you go into A&E, if you're with a wild swimming party, then mention this one, acute pulmonary edema related to swimming and water immersion. And again, it's self-limiting, usually requires some degree of treatment of drugs put into your arms to get rid of the fluid. But once it settles down, then you're fine.
Right, having scared the bejeebers out of everyone...
Right, I don't want to do that.
No, let me just ask you this. It's a question that you suggested when we were talking earlier. Are there any medical conditions that would be a problem if you wanted to take up wild swimming? Because I think many people have been inspired to do so, and the weather is getting better, they might be more tempted to have a go, because it's getting warmer, isn't it?
Someone
commented and asked me on one of my videos, I've had a heart condition, can I take up wild swimming? I was like, well, how on earth do I know? Check with your doctor and make sure you're with a group of people when you go swimming. Yeah. My reply, but come on, you're the doctor.
I think that's a good reply, Simon. Yeah, so I think common sense. So we want to encourage people to go swimming of any sort, including wild swimming, if you do have heart conditions, if you do have diabetes, if you do have anything wrong with you, arthritis, anything, because exercise is good for you and great mental and physical well-being from swimming in general and wild swimming in particular. So we want to encourage that. Broadly speaking, for any of these sorts of things, if you're allowed to drive a car, if you've got, say, diabetes, if you've got epilepsy as two sort of kind of conditions where you can kind of collapse in the water, if somebody has said you're okay to drive a car for either of those two conditions, then you're probably going to be okay swimming and going wild swimming. any doubt about that sort of thing, I think speak to your doctor about it. But there's no reason somebody who's got diabetes, somebody on insulin, got good control of their insulin, no reason why they can't. And again, with epilepsy, if you've got epilepsy but you're allowed to drive a car, again, I can't see any particular problem. The things that do catch people out maybe are the heart conditions. So if you've had a heart attack and you're rehabilitating yourself, then I think it's all about doing it slowly and doing it according to what the physiotherapists and so on are telling you is possible to do. But certainly wild swimming and cold immersion will put your heart under a stress. So if you've got an abnormal heart rhythm and you're on pills because of an abnormal heart rhythm, maybe ask your doctor about that first. But again, it's all about understanding your own body, slowly adjustment, slow immersion and so on, and then understanding your own body and having people with you. That's the key thing, I think.
Is it worth, you know, trying the cold shower thing before you go, or have you never bothered with that?
I don't know.
From that facial expression, the answer is somewhat sceptical about that.
I don't know. I suppose common sense would say if you try a shower at home and you've got, you know, and you've got a heart condition and it makes you feel funny, then the message would be don't do it. Yeah.
You see, the thing that amazes me, and I still find this amazing, is how your body, everybody's body, does adapt. Yeah. I wasn't swimming over the coldest part of this year. I had a little thing going on, and so I didn't want to go in the water. And then when I tried to get back in, my wife's going across the lock. She's swimming a kilometre. I was like, my goodness, I'm not sure I can go in here. It's really cold. It's phenomenal the way what our bodies can do. It's astonishing.
Absolutely.
That's got to be good for you, hasn't it?
Absolutely. Really? Yes.
In terms of the chemicals it releases and what have you, are you aware of all that when you're swimming?
The whole endorphin thing.
Endorphin, serotonin, all these sort of stuff that's going on.
A lot of people talk about it. I personally don't think I get an endorphin high afterwards. Maybe just because I do it so regularly and I know what to expect and I know what's happening to me and I've got this kind of insight into understanding my cold physiology and heat loss and stuff like that. So I'm kind of thinking about all that sort of stuff all the time. I'm age 69, so I'm still wild swimming at the age 69, and I continue to do so for as long as I can do.
If you'd like to see the videos I did with Dr. Douglas, head to the Always Another Adventure YouTube channel. There's one in the wild swimming playlist, also one about ticks and Lyme disease, on which he's something of an expert. If you've enjoyed this, it would be great if you'd consider supporting the show by buying me a virtual coffee. There's a link in the show notes and on the website, alwaysanotheradventure.com. I'm Simon Willis. Thanks for listening. Bye.